It's Friday. Here's the takeaway for June 9th, 2017.
I think there's a big difference in kicking superior officers out of the Oval Office, looking the FBI director in the eye and saying, I hope you let this go.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And there was everything yesterday. The president lied, we heard. Speculation about furtively recorded tapes, we heard. Leaked memos, we heard about. Obstruction of justice, all emerged in historic Senate testimony from fired FBI director James Comey. An attempted rebuttal from President Donald Trump's deputy press secretary insisted the president is not a liar. And a statement from Trump's personal attorney, Mark Kasowitz, declared Comey one of an army of leakers. And Kasowitz's client, the president, cleared. But there was no argument from anywhere on the severity of the allegations of Russian interference in the U.S. 2016 elections. Here's James Comey.
The reason this is such a big deal is we have this big, messy, wonderful country where we fight with each other all the time, but nobody tells us what to think, what to fight about, what to vote for, except other Americans. And that's wonderful and often painful, but we're talking about a foreign government that, using technical intrusion and lots of other methods, tried to shape the way we think, we vote, we act. That is a big deal. And people need to recognize it. It's not about Republicans or Democrats. They're coming after America, which I hope we all love equally.
We anxiously return now to our reliable and experienced voice on all these matters or investigations, Robert Ray, former federal prosecutor who served as independent counsel for the Whitewater investigation, currently a partner at Thompson and Knight. Welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, you had Comey saying, I was slandered. What's your response to that? That whole business of Rosenstein's memo and the reason that Comey was fired, that amounted to a slanderous, lying treatment of him by the President of the United States.
Well, Director Comey was quite clear in his testimony yesterday that he didn't buy it, you know, as being the reason why he was fired.
I take the President at his word that I was fired because of the Russia investigation. Something about the way I was conducting it, the President felt created pressure on him that he wanted to relieve.
As his testimony indicated, he took the job as FBI director because of the fact that he could act independently. And he has struggled with that issue now over the course of three presidencies. First, President George W. Bush, then President Obama and his dealings with Loretta Lynch, and now finally with President Trump. It is not an easy position to be in. And of relatively recent vintage is the notion that an FBI director should remain independent, and there are structural reasons for that imposed by the Congress, which is a 10-year term intended to be one where the FBI director acts independently of any administration for reasons that we learned most recently in Watergate, and that is a president using the tools and powers or interfering with the tools and powers of the criminal law and the FBI is a dangerous thing.
The question of trust came up again when Comey was asked about his propensity to write down notes.
I knew that there might come a day when I would need a record of what had happened, not just to defend myself, but to defend the FBI and our integrity as an institution and the independence of our investigative function.
That's the riveting part of the testimony. You know, this is how government works in the real world. And he made an assessment. You know, he said, and he was asked, well, why did you do that? It was one part who I was dealing with, one part the context, meaning that he was asked to see the president alone. And the third part was, you know, what was being discussed.
What did it feel like to have the president of the United States say, I hope that XYZ happens in this case, meaning I hope the investigation into the Russia business and Flynn goes away. He was asked by among the most conservative senators on the panel that question. And
he was quite clear what the response was.
I took it as a direction.
Right.
I mean, this is the president of the United States with me alone saying, I hope this. I took it as this is what he wants me to do. Now, I didn't obey that, but that's the way I took it.
You may have taken it as a direction, but that's not what he said.
Correct.
He said, I hope.
Those are exact words, okay. Correct.
You don't know of anyone that's ever been charged for hoping something. Is that a fair statement?
I don't, as I sit here.
What the president's hopes and intimations are, and that's a significant thing when you're the president having that power, is quite a different question than whether or not hopes and intimations add up to corrupt intent that would be provable in the context of trying to show that the president committed obstruction of justice. So I remain convinced, notwithstanding the testimony yesterday, that Bob Mueller will quickly conclude – how quick, I guess, is open to question – that there's not a case there to be brought, let's say, once the president leaves office, for the president to face indictment and prosecution for obstruction of justice. I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Now, you are making the distinction that Donald Trump saying, I hope, you know, my daughter, you know, wins the beauty contest is different than I hope something happens that I know you can take care of for me.
Sure.
Those two are very, very different. But
understand the difference. But look, I had a similar situation arise during the Whitewater investigation. As you know, Whitewater just wasn't about Whitewater. It became ultimately about Lewinsky. But before we even got to Monica Lewinsky, in the middle of all of that was the firing of the White House travel office employees.
Right.
There was no question in my mind after a thorough investigation that Hillary Clinton was unhappy with the work of the travel office, and unhappiness was expressed. You know, she didn't have an official position, but she was in fact the president's spouse and the first lady. And if the first lady expresses hopes and intimations about the course of the White House travel office's work and people take action to fire the travel office, the question was when she testified under oath that she had nothing to do with the firing of the travel office employees, was that testimony false? My judgment was absolutely it was false, not unlike what we have here. You know, did Director Comey think that he was being told to end the investigation? He testified quite clearly. That's what I understood the president to mean. But understanding what the president to mean or any powerful person, including Hillary Clinton in the travel office case, is not the same thing as saying that if someone later on said, well, as the president was asked, did you direct the FBI director to end the investigation? He can truthfully answer, no, I did not, because he didn't order him to do it. He didn't tell him to do it. All he said was, I hope you can see your way to. Now, we all understand that when a powerful person and the most powerful person in the world, the president of the United States, talks about what he'd like to see, you know, the idea is that the people who work for you do what you ask, generally speaking, unless what you're being asked to do is a violation of law.
And a defense would be, you know, I really hope this investigation goes away because we got problems in North Korea and I need to not be distracted
and
here.
He's
and
right,
that's a perfect defense.
And he's right about that.
Right,
the country
right.
is being
right.
impaired while this cloud hangs over the mm-hmm. administration. And he's entitled to push back, right? And if he pushes back, he certainly shouldn't be subject to criminal prosecution once he leaves office. I mean, there's got to be sort of a free zone there to be able to make decisions as he is entrusted to do as the chief executive of the United States, including if he likes, even if he had directed Jim Comey to end the investigation. That's his prerogative. Now, he may be subject to impeachment for that act, but he shouldn't be subject to prosecution. He's entitled to make personnel decisions, and he's entitled to tell the FBI, I want you to stop this investigation, or I want you to take a look and investigate this rather than something else.
Impeachment is a political act. That's a reminder that anyone who understands the Constitution needs to remember. We're going to talk about that in 2 seconds. But first, what do you make of the Trump response, his personal attorney saying, number one, Comey is one of the leakers. And second thing, that he's completely exonerated because, as we know from the public record, Comey says, and was even asked in the testimony, that you know, whether Trump was being investigated for a particular aspect of all of this, and the answer to that was no. Is number one, the president exonerated by that statement? Will Mueller think so? And number two, is this question of being a leaker something that you find credible?
No, I think the leaker part is a distraction. I mean, you know, first of all, what did he leak? He leaked his own mental impressions that were documented and recorded in official memos. I mean,
so not classified privileged information.
Not classified. I mean, arguably, it could be seen to be subject to executive privilege, but I think an equal argument in response to that is that by the president's own words and actions to discuss it, he probably waived it.
On this exoneration question, he was not being investigated personally.
That's a significant point. I mean, when I saw even before Director Comey's testimony, the night before, the afternoon before when the statement was released, I'm reading down the statement and I did what a lot of people do. When I came across the first instance where Jim Comey told the president, "You're not under investigation," I wrote number one down. Hmm. And then I kept reading and I looked and there it was, second time, number two. And then I finally got to the end and sure enough, there it was, Director Comey on the third occasion assuring the president that you were not under investigation, number three. So that means that, you know, President Trump, at least with regard to that, was telling the truth.
Here's the civics lesson. So impeachment is a political act. It's not really dependent upon the specifics of crime, except indirectly. What it really depends on is there evidence in looking at the hearings yesterday of Republicans who might be inclined to give President Donald Trump a really hard time in this investigation, and the votes may suddenly go against the president of the United States. Quick impression on that?
My quick impression is that until the Congress changes party, which is to say it can't happen until the midterm elections, I do not believe that the president needs to be concerned about impeachment, either in the House through articles of impeachment, or more importantly, that the Senate on a bipartisan basis would be able to convict on that basis. That's not going to happen in the foreseeable future. Now, if the Congress changes hands and the House and the Senate are both controlled by Democrats, you know, that might be a different question. But that's not going to happen in the next 2 years.
You recognize this voice?
What did the president know and when did he know it?
Yes. Howard Baker.
Tennessee senator, Republican.
Yes, during Watergate.
Who essentially was part of the group of Republicans that turned, that for whatever reason saw Watergate as a significant crisis for the presidency and turned on Richard Nixon, their president. And in the case of Baker, maybe also saw, hey, you know, the opportunity here is for me to become a national political figure, which he did become.
That's why this is a political issue. Again, the system is designed structurally by the framers to require, in order to remove a president, if something extraordinary has happened, and in the political context of parties, which weren't entirely envisioned by the framers, but ultimately, you know, in short order in our history became, you know, the operative feature of a democracy, at least in this country, it requires, in order to meet the high threshold of a two-thirds vote to remove in the Senate, there be a bipartisan consensus, meaning both parties have to be on board with the removal of a president. That's an extraordinary thing. And that's not going to happen, obviously, at least in my view, in the current environment, unless that environment changes.
Robert Ray, former federal prosecutor and independent counsel for the Whitewater investigation during the Clinton years, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Expensive Bentleys aren't known for breakdowns and backfiring, but the polished sheen of British conservatism is tarnished in a monumental backfire from those snap elections that Prime Minister Theresa May called to increase her parliamentary majority before all-important Brexit negotiations begin in just 10 days. Increase her majority? How about her party lost it altogether? Conservatives cling to power weakly in a coalition with the Democratic Unionists in Northern Ireland, a pro-Brexit Northern Irish party. That's how parliamentary systems work.
I have just been to see Her Majesty the Queen, and I will now form a government. A government that can provide certainty and lead Britain forward at this critical time for our country.
Meanwhile, the Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, looks more like a sleek Jaguar 12-cylinder, vastly outperforming expectations. The Labour Party gained 30 parliamentary seats.
What's happened is people have said they've had quite enough of austerity politics. They've had quite enough of cuts in public expenditure, underfunding our health service, underfunding our schools and our education service, and not giving our young people the chance they deserve in our society.
So Corbyn's future is secure, but Conservative Party leader Theresa May's future is anything but. A new party leader for the Tories would mean a new prime minister in the UK. But again, as Dawn Foster, columnist for The Guardian, explains, that's also how things work under this parliamentary system.
So at 10 o'clock when the polls close, there's always an exit poll. And 2 years ago, everybody was completely shocked, expected Labour to lose, and it predicted a Tory majority. So this time it came out and it predicted a hung parliament. And yet again, everyone was unbelievably shocked. So initially, everyone thought the poll had to be wrong. The polls had oscillated a lot throughout the campaign. And as the night went on, it seemed that things were a lot worse for Theresa May. And finally, when it got down to counting, she was 8 short of a majority. And all she could do was turn to the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland to ask them to form a coalition with her.
Clearly, Labour has better capacity to mobilise its membership. And that has proved to be true.
Oh, no, completely. I think the big thing with Labour was the fact that in the past, most politicians have assumed that the electorate is stable. So people who don't vote will never vote. So all you can do is convince a different party's voters to vote for you. Whereas what we saw this time was Corbyn and his team realising that, you know, it would be very, very difficult to persuade a Tory voter to vote for socialist Jeremy Corbyn, but you could turn to the young people. So we saw Grime for Corbyn, which was lots of, you know, young black musicians coming out for him. And if you look at the youth vote, it's incredible. Last election it was 66%. This time it was nearly 74%. So Corbyn and Labour realised that the best thing to do was to get people who never vote and bring them on. So I think that's exactly what happened with Labour.
Is this a voting for our future, thinking about a Labour policy, a Labour vision, or is this a bit of a raving loony kind of let's upset the apple cart, pretty much like what happened in the United States with Donald Trump?
I think it's a lot more like Bernie Sanders. I think a lot of young people always felt that politics wasn't about them, it didn't include them, etc. And all of a sudden you saw lots and lots of young people realising that actually policies did affect them, actually their voice could be heard, and realising that all they had to do was get the vote out and all of a sudden they could change the face of Parliament. So this is why you have a guy who is, you know, 68 years old appealing to people who are 18, 19, 20, etc. Just giving them the policies they want, saying you can have a voice and you can change this. And just getting them out on the doorstep, teaching them how to campaign, and just making them feel as if they're listened to instead of simply relying on their parents' votes.
What's the story within the Tories?
So a lot of Conservatives didn't think going in, you know, for a snap election that finished 10 days before Brexit negotiations start was a good idea. But she convinced them that it was a good idea because she could get them a really, really big majority, and then anything they wanted in Parliament, they could get through. And instead, the exact opposite's happened. She started with a slim majority of, 12 or 13 seats, and she's finished 8 short. So she's actually worsened their position. She's actually made Jeremy Corbyn look even stronger. And now Conservatives are baying for her blood. I mean, I spoke to a Conservative MP earlier who said that, if they had anything to do with it, she'd be gone within a week. She's come out and said she won't resign, but I think her position's completely untenable. So no Tory MP I spoke to wants to stand up for her. We've already had a few live on TV just completely call for her to resign and say that her campaign was appalling, in the words of one Anna Soubry. But equally, nobody will come out and defend her. Boris Johnson, Foreign Secretary, won't. David Davis, the Brexit Secretary. They were all asked repeatedly by the BBC if they would back and support May. They all refused to come on TV and reply to anybody.
I mean, the question is, what happens to Brexit? You've raised it and people have been talking about it. I mean, the fate of Theresa May is less important than what this really does to the Brexit vote and the details and procedures there.
I think it makes it even worse. I mean, I spoke to a colleague in Brussels today, and he said that every single person he saw looked at him, laughed, and asked what was going on in Britain. People already thought that Theresa May was quite weak on Brexit in Brussels. I mean, Juncker, who is, the head over there, was quoted in a leaked report saying that he thought she was on another galaxy and that she didn't understand how Brexit negotiations would actually go. I mean, she told the public that she needed a majority so she'd have a strong hand in Brexit negotiations. And I think that's backfired on her because now she doesn't have a majority. So she's essentially told the British public that she's going to have a really weak hand in Brexit.
The Brexit question is more about the state of the entire British electorate. Do we know the answer to that question? Whatever the fate of Theresa May is with this, strange coalition.
I think at this point, nobody really knows what's going to happen. I mean, leaving the European Union is completely unprecedented. I think Theresa May, could easily be forced out, etc. But also, if she wants to get anything through Parliament, she's got such a weak majority now. All she needs is for 8 Tory MPs to rebel, and they can't get anything passed.
The Irish, I believe, are pro staying in the Union. Of course, Ireland is a separate country, but the Unionists, being right up there on the island, do they have a Brexit position that's clear?
Yes. So in Northern Ireland, at the moment, there are two parties. So Sinn Féin, who are the Republicans who think that we should have a united Ireland, and Sinn Féin are completely anti-Brexit. But the DUP, the Democratic Unionists, who Theresa May is going into coalition with, campaigned for Brexit. They want to see a hard border brought in. They want to see the border between Northern and Southern Ireland policed and, militarised again. And obviously, a lot of people are terrified of that. A lot of people in Northern Ireland, I've got family there, travel to the south every day for work. They've got friends and family there. And if you bring back a militarized border with police patrolling it, fences, etc., then you really do run the risk, a very, very high risk of bringing back trouble, bringing back memories of the troubles in Ireland, and almost certainly bringing back, conflict and paramilitary organizations.
Dawn Foster is a columnist for The Guardian. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Returning to U.S. politics for a moment, Kansas Republicans, led by their conservative governor, Sam Brownback, made history this decade with huge tax cuts to reduce the size and scope of government and the services it delivers in that state. This week, the Republican-controlled legislature voted to override the governor's veto of a bill to try and get some of that government back and raise $1.2 billion over the next 2 years in the process. Republican Representative Melissa Rooker from District 25 says the signs look good to her that the days of extreme ideological conservatism are over in her state, and maybe even in the nation.
Well, for Kansas, it started in 2010 with the election of Sam Brownback, and there was a complete takeover in the 2012 elections. So we're sort of ahead of the curve. And in 2016, in our election cycle, the state swung back towards the center in a pretty significant way. So we have 47 freshman lawmakers serving, and it's a new coalition of more moderate, more traditional Republicans and more Democrats serving in our Kansas House and Senate. And together, we've brought the state back from the brink of a fiscal crisis.
So up until this week, the idea of what's the matter with Kansas, they're always voting against their interests. You can no longer say that. The state of Kansas has decided that one of the roles of government is to deliver services to the people, and Governor Brownback got it all wrong.
Exactly. We've got a long history of caring about the quality of our public schools and really caring about the people around us. Kansans are pragmatic people, and things went too far, and the populace spoke in this election cycle. So while it was a very strange election night for the country, I would say in Kansas, we got it right.
We've been talking today about the consequences in Britain of the election over there and the weakness of Prime Minister Theresa May. Different systems, obviously, but Governor Brownback, in a sense, is in a kind of Theresa May predicament. How weakened is he as a governor because of this? I mean, he's not going to leave office, but how weakened is he?
He still wields the veto pen. So ultimately, he holds all the cards. That's been the struggle all session, is that as we pass different pieces of legislation, with the stroke of a pen, he can stop it in its tracks. And this week was the first time we succeeded in overriding the veto. We're going to debate our budget today, and that is the last piece of legislation we have to put in place. We are a part-time legislature. So we've proven we can hold the line on our legislative work, and hopefully we will continue to make forward progress.
Finally, do you think there's a trend afoot possibly that Americans on the state level will begin thinking hard about, all right, we need to do X, Y, and Z, and to pay for it, we're going to have to raise our own taxes, and that's going to happen here? Or is it not gotten that far?
Well, I would hope that the country takes notice the trouble that Kansas got itself in and the struggle to set it right. I know Illinois has had their share of struggles. So I do think that the services that state governments deliver matter to the people and are more present and noticeable in their everyday lives. So, yes, I hope this is the beginning of a trend where state governments right-size themselves instead of trying these radical policies that we certainly shrank the size of government, but it certainly didn't work for the people.
Representative Melissa Rooker is a Republican member of the Kansas House of Representatives representing District Number 25. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
It's showtime.
Showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
Everybody, it's showtime.
Showtime.
It's showtime.
Showtime.
It's showtime.
Showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
Don't say it, please. Don't say it.
No, I have to say it, Mitch. Showtime.
Friday movies, and that means it's time for Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. We've got three very interesting movies here. You know, my son, my seven-year-old, last night learned the word mummified.
Aha!
Aha!
Well, you can really show him exactly what that means
exactly.
This weekend.
Arminet understood power was not given; it had to be taken. She made a choice to embrace evil.
Tell all, Rafer.
Well, this is the high-tech, big-budget reboot of The Mummy, the 1932 classic with Boris Karloff. And this is trying to be the big, splashy, Marvel-style relaunch of what Universal is calling the Dark Universe. They're going to relaunch The Wolfman, Frankenstein, Hunchback, Phantom of the Opera.
Really?
In something called a Monsterverse that's going to have all these overlapping stories.
Oh, I love that idea.
It's a great idea. What you just heard there was Russell Crowe playing, I'm going to spoil this briefly, Dr. Henry Jekyll, who is one of the characters in The Mummy. So what they're trying to go for is a little bit of Nick Fury, you know, in the Marvel world. Now it's
right.
Dr. Jekyll,
who's
kind of hunting evil across the world. The problem here is that this movie is trying to do way too much. I didn't buy the high-tech mummy. I didn't buy the zombies that come into this movie. I didn't buy the zombie comedy.
Swimming zombies.
Swimming zombies, that's right. I think, you know, this movie is very confused, very chaotic, very hectic, and I think in the end, despite the star power of Tom Cruise, who's always great, it just didn't work, and it feels a lot clumsier and a lot cornier to me.
Well, that's too bad. Movie number two is It Comes at Night, classic terror thriller for the summer. Let's listen to a clip.
Oh, God, I'm sure I'm forgetting a few things.
There's plenty of time to work out all the details.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Overload. Well, just settle in.
Yeah.
And we'll get working in the morning. And welcome.
I mean, this is just this classic horror movie where this is our safe place.
That's right.
And, of course, it's not.
That's Joel Edgerton and Carmen Ejogo playing a husband and wife. That's their idea of a warm welcome that they're giving to this other family who's going to hunker down in their cabin to try and shield themselves from this mysterious pandemic that has basically decimated the world. So this is a very, very intense, very personal, small-scale claustrophobic version of that story. It's not World War Z.
No exit.
Yes, there you go. And it works. I think it's very intense. You've got a good feeling of dread and anxiety in this film. I'm not sure it says anything that new to me in the end, except that, you know, when people are scared, they get desperate and they turn against each other. I enjoyed the film because it does work on a kind of a brutal, emotional gut punch level. It's almost, the horror is almost more emotional than gore driven. But I'm just not sure it was saying anything that new to me about this genre.
Also in wide release, a movie called Megan Levy. It's a heartstring puller from the Iraq War. Let's hear a clip.
So where are you from?
New York.
I am, me too. But you're not a Yankees fan though, right?
Born and bred.
Oh, come on. Dagger to my heart, really? Well, I guess we'll never speak again, Megan. Chico, we don't talk to Yankees fans, right?
Good boy.
This has got to be the preliminaries of a much deeper story.
Yeah, Chico is that soldier's dog, and Megan Levy, played by Kate Mara, is going to get her own dog, bomb-sniffing dog, and they're going to ship out to Iraq. Her dog, Rex, German Shepherd, is notoriously aggressive, but she manages through patience, kindness, and willpower to turn this dog into a brother-in-arms, into a comrade. And it's a true story. I think part of it works really well, especially the opening scene where you see Megan Levy as this dead-end youth kicking around in this small town. She's got a druggy past. She's working these terrible jobs. She's got no purpose. She passes the Marine recruiter's office, and next thing you know, she's on a bus to boot camp in South Carolina. That had some real grit and some realism to me. The rest of the film, a little formulaic, a little bit, I'm not sure if it overdoes the corniness, but it just has these kind of beats that sort of unfold in this very formulaic, rote way.
Megan Levy, It Comes at Night, The Mummy. Those are the three films for this weekend. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and The Takeaway. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, John. You too.
The whole war on obesity is a war on people.
It's not going to be easy. It's going to be an uphill battle.
We are really not healthy.
I want to be taken seriously, no matter what my weight.
So you're always in like this low-level crisis, pitting your regular bills against whether or not you're going to buy healthy food for your kids.
So obesity is a complex disease.
The question is, do we have an environment that supports responsible decision?
And is a greater public health challenge than anything else, in any virus, any other disease, and even terrorism.
Obesity is not simply a medical condition or a numbered statement of someone's body weight, we learn. It's also a place and a people's response to radically changing places. In some Native American communities, those changes have meant radically altered diets, disruptions of locavore self-sustaining economies, with the result, significant health problems. Sherelle Parfait-Dadar is chief of the Grand Caillou Dulac Band of the Biloxi Chittimachi Choctaw Tribe in southern Louisiana.
Oh my goodness, there's so much that I love about where I live.
But that land that Sherelle loves is seemingly vanishing before her eyes.
We've lost a lot of land. The land is not fertile like it used to be when I was a lot younger. You know, we can't keep small livestock anymore. We can't plant directly into the ground anymore. It's gotten more challenging to live here where we are and still maintain the traditions that we used to have, especially food-wise.
Roughly 16 square miles erode every year from the Louisiana coast, a result of climate change and rising sea levels, and with that loss of land is the loss of this tribe's way of life. So to reclaim that life and history, Chief Sherelle is now part of a group called the First Peoples Conservation Council. They've been brainstorming ways to preserve their land and their more traditional food supplies in spite of land losses. Barry Yeoman is a freelance journalist with the Food and Environmental Reporting Network, and he's been reporting on Native communities like Chief Sherelle's, who are seeing direct links between climate change, the food they eat, and the impact it has on health. He and Chief Sherelle and Mary Harris, WNYC health reporter and co-host of the podcast Only Human, shared an illuminating conversation, which is part of our week-long obesity series.
What strikes me as I travel in Louisiana, especially along the coast, is that it really is at the forefront of environmental change, and it does feel like it's environmental change on steroids. You drive along the coast, and you see open water where there just wasn't open water even 10 years ago. I remember I was visiting with a tribe near Chief Sherelle, the Pointerchin tribe, and we were out on a boat, and the boat was on open water, and it said on the GPS that we were on land.
Oh my gosh.
And we were using a GPS map that was only a few years old. And so coastal erosion has happened so fast that the tribes in Louisiana have had to learn to adapt really super quickly.
Sherelle, yeah. I'm wondering, how has that all trickled down to how healthy you and your family feel?
We're not, okay? we are really not healthy, okay? We had very, very healthy diets, like during my grandparents' time. They were eating things that were what we consider pure or kosher, right? It was homegrown. It didn't have any modification. It didn't have all these pesticides. The grounds were healthier. The soil was healthier. We didn't eat any kind of modified foods, these boxed foods. We didn't eat fast food. We had a mostly vegetable diet, very little meat. We don't really have access to a lot of that today because we can't grow it like we used to.
So it would all be grown from your own farms,
right,
and gardens.
It was all grown. And now with all of the land loss and the saltwater intrusion and the sinkage and, you know, with all of these negative impacts that are happening, we're not able to maintain that lifestyle anymore. So now we have to go to the grocery stores and purchase a lot of what we would have normally planted or raised, and that's quite expensive. A lot of us can't really afford those things, so we have to go into purchasing things that are much more affordable, and we still have big families, all right? I myself have four children.
Wow. What are you buying to feed those kids?
Well, you know, I try to buy as healthy as possible, but sometimes I can't. You know, sometimes I have to substitute something like a hamburger helper, right, because it's very inexpensive and it can feed my kids. Managing a grocery bill becomes very difficult. And you look at my generation today, right, you look at that timeline and you start seeing the decline in health. Diabetes is rampant. High cholesterol is rampant. We're losing people to cancer at an astronomical rate. Heart disease, I mean, you name it, we have it. If you go on to some of the native lands, right, that have the casinos, and you go into some of these restrooms, and there's quite a few, you actually have, like, diabetes testing kits, okay, to check your sugar. Diabetes is that rampant that it's a good thing, but it's kind of startling in a way that we've had to go to that extent.
You know, Cheryl, you and a few other tribal chiefs have started the First Peoples Conservation Council. Tell me a little bit more about what you're trying to do there.
Well, we're in different locations. We're different tribes, but we're all going through the same thing. And we're looking for any and all resources possible, any answers we can find to tackle the issues that we face. And it's all about protecting and preserving.
One thing that strikes me about what the tribes in Louisiana are going through right now is that these are issues facing Native Americans in particular all over the country. In Louisiana, it's land loss. But in other places, it's been forced displacement. It's been urbanization. And if you look at the numbers, they're really startling. I mean, if you look at four-year-olds, 16% of white children are obese and 31% of Native American children are. If you look at school children or older people, the statistics for diabetes, for obesity, for heart disease are through the roof among Native Americans. And scientists are in pretty much agreement that this is because of Western diet.
So, Cheryl, I wonder, what are you most afraid of losing in all this?
We're losing everything. I don't think you can say that you're most afraid of losing one particular thing here. We're losing everything. We're losing our way of life. We're losing our identity. We're losing our homes. We're trying the best we can to not only stop it in its tracks and preserve what we have left and adapt, but to also take what we have accomplished and learned, and share it with others so that they don't have to go through this.
Cheryl, do you feel optimistic or pessimistic right now?
Always optimistic. Always. We have to be. You know, every day is a new day that we can make something positive happen. You know, more people are listening. Us coming together and reaching out like we've been doing is starting to wake a lot of people up. And it's kind of hard to miss when it's right in front of you, right? You start seeing all of the statistics. You see the truth. So people are waking up. So we're very optimistic that we're going to be successful. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but we will.
Barry Yeoman, Chief Sherelle Parfait-Dardar, I just want to thank you both for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure.
Barry Yeoman is a freelance journalist with the Food and Environmental Reporting Network, and Chief Sherelle Parfait-Dardar is the head of the Duloc Band of the Biloxi Chittimacha Confederation in southern Louisiana.
We exist as canaries, 6 million little yellow birds fluttering. We molt our feathers across the south and try to keep where the buildings hang in the clouds. We sing bird songs like piano music.
Last night, young Chastity Hale, Zara Batlavi, and Benjamin Cruz were among three of the recipients of the annual Scholastic Art and Writing Awards. The winners were honored in a joyous ceremony at Carnegie Hall.
And drop fingertips of seeds onto aged keyboards so that up-tempo strokes can grow into crescendo. We are trembling with hope.
They were awarded for their works in both spoken and written word and in visual art. The three teens we spoke with, one African-American, one Pakistani-American, and one Hispanic, looked at the national topic of identity.
Solemn expressions, a neatly packed suitcase. Silence. The overwhelming kind which rushes like a river, the kind you swim against upstream, as if the absence of voices drowns you. I remember numbers that I still cannot comprehend. 83F, C4, 26,000 feet per second, 120 pounds. But despite all these little fragments of memories, I do not remember that day.
Visual artist Benjamin Cruz surprised by delivering in his winning entry an identity not his own. He chose to represent, in some of his paintings, people not of his background or even generation, the people forced to live in Japanese internment camps during World War II.
For me, I like identity in art is creating something that's personal, and that doesn't necessarily have to be like autobiographical, like in case of Humble Burdens, which is like about Japanese internment, and that's kind of like about the like identity of being like a minority in America and, you know, facing like oppression and discrimination for like invalid reasons.
How difficult was that? How challenging was that?
It was difficult because all of my references and like information, you know, coming from like during the wartime, like in the 40s, and so I was kind of trying to work from like historical photos, like Ansel Adams, like his series in Manzanar. Mm-hmm. And so like process for me was just trying to draw from like these great portraits of people that actually like lived in the internment camps. And I felt like it was difficult to do it like the amount of justice that it deserved and portray it in a way that isn't like taking it to be my own, but rather like kind of honoring and bringing awareness to all the difficulties that the people had to face in the internment camps.
So you may feel discrimination, a feeling of isolation in America, but you chose to showcase in your art another group.
Yeah.
Chastity, what's your thought?
I would definitely second what Benjamin said. There are just so many aspects of identity that can be explored. It's more than just like race. It's also like experiences, interest, and then there's like collective identity. Like my pieces, they're of course like personal, and they're about like what it means for me to be like a Black American, but then there's also this idea of just like what does it mean to be American in general. Mm-hmm. Like there are just so many like various aspects of identities, I think.
How about you, Sarah?
Our generation was kind of living on this idea that if you have an opinion or feeling or thought, that voicing it to the world is possible and they will listen. I think it's of our generation, it feels a little bit like it's supposed to happen, like you have to do it.
Sounds like what the three of you are saying is, no, these are interchangeable feelings, that this idea of difference and isolation and emergence, you know, doesn't require you to be in the group, that it basically talking about the raw feeling is what it's all about.
Yeah.
I always call poetry like memory alchemy, and so you just sort of...
You are a poet. Go for it. Chastity?
Canada. That's where we're headed. There the sun spills hope like the light from leaky lanterns. the ones that guide us through melancholy forest as we fight the arms of broadleaf trees, which try to pull us back towards sorrow. Secretly, we rest in homes along the route, trying to conjure a sense of safety, a dark fabric against the scape of white space. I lie awake in a bed that is not mine, wrapped in white sheets, surrounded by white walls. In this room, at least in the night, darkness is accepted.
The sun spells hope like light from leaking lanterns?
Yes.
Oh. Zara, you've got an essay for us, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay, great, go ahead.
I remember the moments themselves very briefly, scattered like fractal patterns of a kaleidoscope. On March 11th, 2008, my father's childhood home in Lahore, Pakistan, was demolished in a suicide bombing, desecrating the ancestral grounds of my people. The jarring part, which I myself have yet to face, is that I know why I don't remember. I have tucked the memory deep inside my chest, letting it settle in the sickle-shaped cavity of my ribs because I know exactly what I felt that day. Nothing. My family lost a piece of lineage deep in unsurmountable rubble, and I felt nothing. I had lost nothing. I watched on like an outsider as ruins buried the myths that made my father. He gazed on as kitchen spices, baby cradles, summer nights, and monsoon seasons all fell to their knees. He saw hallowed ground, decades of laughter and birth, of death and mourning. I saw the back of a postcard, an image in a history textbook.
So I'm gathering from that something happened in your ancestral lands, but right. You only knew it from a postcard.
Yes. I mean, what happened was my father, I mean, like his childhood home was destroyed by a suicide bombing. Okay. And I mean, I had barely ever visited. I had barely ever seen it. It was like watching the news, but through my family.
Guilt from not knowing, not having the feelings that your father had?
Guilt from feeling more like an outsider, like the way we watch terrorist attacks in the news or listen to refugees in Syria. We feel like we're outsiders, and I felt like I shouldn't have felt like an outsider when it was my own family. Exactly.
That's this identity, this sort of moving target that is humanity in the 21st century. Congratulations to the three of you.
Thank you.
Winners in the Scholastic Writing and Art Awards. Thanks so much for coming, guys.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Three of last night's Scholastic Art and Writing Award winners all headed to college this fall. Zara Batlavi will attend Loyola University in Chicago, Benjamin Cruz, the Maryland Institute College of Art, and Chastity Hale is headed out to Stanford.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Staples. Staples offers copy and print solutions for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at Staples.com. Staples. It's pro time.
Thanks so much for listening this hour and this entire week. And as your reward, we hope you have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.